A few weeks ago, I started an internship at a local hospital. As a chaplain, I work with people who are facing some of the toughest moments of their lives. People who have suddenly lost a loved one, or who have to make a tough decision, or are facing the end of their own life. I want to be of use to people in these moments and to be present to whatever they are experiencing. This is an important part of my training for ministry, and I want to do my new job well. And yet, I realized pretty quickly after I started the internship that unless I let myself fail some of the time, I will not grow through this experience. I'm going to need to take risks, to take chances doing things I don't know how to do yet. And that means sometimes I will not get it right. I realized I'll probably learn more from my mistakes than from trying to avoid mistakes, trying to be perfect. When I put my foot in my mouth, which, let's be honest, is going to happen, and I say something I wish I hadn't said, I'll have to figure out how to fix the mess I've created and what to do differently next time. If I can accept the fact that everybody makes mistakes, apologize, and forgive myself, I will be able to change. But if I'm harsh with myself instead, I'll feel miserable, ashamed, and defeated. And facing those awful feelings could make me too afraid to try to fix the situation, let alone to try again next time. My first grade teacher, Mrs. Shack, had a saying she taught our class. "Nobody's perfect," she would remind us over and over again. I don't know when I started being hard on myself. I'm only sure it started sometime after first grade. I compared myself to other kids in my class, and I didn't think I measured up. At some point, I decided I wasn't as smart as some of them. A few kids I grew up with had one thing they were really good at, like art or science. I wandered through elementary school, middle school, high school, and in college what my talents and gifts were exactly. Nobody's perfect must have lost some of its power for me by around the third or fourth grade. It turns out I'm not alone. Research shows that by the time most girls reach about the third grade, they see themselves as less attractive than they have before. With their plummeting perceptions of their beauty also goes their self-esteem. Self-esteem is particularly problematic for women in this country. For many of us, our self-worth depends on how good-looking we think we are. There are many problems that can come with low self-esteem, but it turns out that even high self-esteem has problems. We have to feel special and above average to have high self-esteem. This means we have to pit ourselves against other people and put them down so that we can feel good about ourselves. Narcissism is an unintended consequence of self-esteem. It can lead to bullying, prejudice, and racism. Self-esteem can come from our successes too, but we are hardly successful all of the time. Many of us fail more often than we succeed, especially if we're open to taking risks and challenges. My husband is a computer scientist. Many of the people in his field who have successful startup companies have had one that failed first. When you fail at something, how do you feel? As I said earlier, I usually feel some combination of guilt, shame, and blame. In other words, I feel pretty awful and sort of alone. I've learned a new phrase to use instead of "nobody's perfect." I learned it from my ministers, my mentors, and teachers in seminary. I don't need to be perfect. I don't have to get straight A's. They say I only need to be good enough. Good enough. We all make mistakes. We all go through hard times. We all have difficult feelings, and we all need compassion. This is the core of self-compassion. Self-compassion means being gentle and kind with ourselves rather than harsh or critical. When we're suffering with difficult feelings, especially feelings like inadequacy, despair, confusion, or stress. When Kristen Neff was in graduate school, she found herself in the midst of a really difficult divorce. She felt guilt and shame about her broken marriage, and she started doubting whether she would be able to finish her degree or become a research scientist. She decided to try a Buddhist meditation group, thinking that meditation might help her cope. The first night Kristen attended the group, the leader talked about how important it is for each person to have compassion for him or herself. She learned how to talk to herself like she would talk to a good friend. Kristen Neff realized that this was exactly what she needed. She needed to be kinder to herself and to give herself compassion for her difficult situation and feelings. Treating ourselves with kindness and understanding when we are suffering, are stressed out, or have made a mistake is an important part of mindful self-compassion. So Kristen used self-compassion to help get her through graduate school, and she finished her PhD. And in her postdoctoral work, Kristen Neff became a pioneering researcher on mindful self-compassion. Many years later, Kristen's son Rowan was diagnosed with autism. She used self-compassion to relate to her complicated feelings of grief and shame about Rowan's diagnosis. She had to accept that this was difficult and let herself grieve so she could accept the situation and accept Rowan for who he is. She had to realize that everybody faces difficult situations and feelings like hers. What does it mean to be human? To me, being human means being perfectly imperfect. We are imperfect, and so are our lives. This is our shared experience. It's our common humanity. In my self-compassion training, I've learned how to ask how I am the same as other people instead of comparing myself to others and asking how am I different. This is especially helpful when something bad happens. When we experience a loss or an illness, for example, it's easy to feel cut off and isolated, even from our friends and family. When I've gone through hard times, it seems like everyone around me is okay while I silently am suffering inside. Telling myself I am alone in this way only makes me feel worse. When we can recognize that we all have hard times, we also feel more connected to other people. In one of my favorite benedictions in our hymnal, Wayne Arneson reminds us, "Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone." I think spreading the message that you are not alone is one of the most important things we do at church. This church is a unique place because we can be authentic here. We want to be able to be ourselves and to know who others really are. We come together to share our lives with one another in this community. When we talk about our troubles and ask for support, we spread the message that you are not alone. This can be a life-saving message for people who are suffering. We also have to remember to receive it ourselves too. When I worked at a summer camp during college, I saw over and over how crisis can bring people together. Just imagine how quickly our staff of 30 became a team working as one when a mother bear and her cub wandered through the volleyball court during our evening program one night. Connecting with other people who are in crisis or need support is often the only thing that can help us feel a little better. So I wanted to show you a short animated video this morning, but since we're outside, I'm going to ask Richard to play the audio for you. And it's an excerpt from a talk by researcher Brené Brown. So it's about 3 minutes long.
So what is empathy and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
So if you want to watch that online, Google Power of Empathy and Brené Brown, and you'll find it. It's a really cute animated video. So you can imagine there's a bear standing at the top of this deep, dark hole and a fox sitting down below. And the bear looks down, or it's the other way around, I guess, and looks down and says, you want a sandwich? Even though I can't remember ever saying that, I know the feeling of not knowing what to say when someone starts talking about their troubles. Being with someone who is hurting isn't easy. It takes vulnerability and courage to connect with my difficult feelings so I can listen to someone else's pain. Vulnerability may be the most important part of compassion and of love. It's what makes empathy and compassion sacred. Unitarian Universalist minister Chris Fry told me this story about a brilliant but rather abrasive doctor who went to Rachel Remen for counseling. The doctor was so burnt out that he wanted to quit his practice. Rachel asked him to keep a daily journal and write down anything that surprised him. He discovered that he almost never experienced his feelings as they happened. When he realized that he'd had certain feelings, they took him by surprise later, and not always in a good way. This meant he couldn't connect with his patients, even though he was technically a great doctor. As he started paying attention to his emotions in his body in the present moment, he cut down the time between experiencing an emotion and knowing he'd had the emotion. As the distance between the two points closed, he found he was much more connected to and compassionate towards his patients and himself. For the first time, he felt his patients loved him. He found a new joy in being a doctor. Now, noticing my feelings isn't easy for me either. When my mom came to stay with us one weekend last summer, my car was broken into while we were out for a walk at a local park, and her purse was stolen on the 4th of July. I was so frustrated, and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't bring the purse back, and I couldn't tell the person who'd stolen it, how they'd wrecked our holiday, and created a real mess for my mom. I felt helpless. When I realized how frustrated I was, I just started repeating to myself over and over, "I'm angry. I'm so angry." I've learned that before I can give myself compassion, I have to accept that I'm suffering. Instead of wishing I could just feel good again, I try to notice and name hard feelings and let them happen. I try to say to myself, "This is a moment of suffering," or, "You poor thing. I know this is really hard right now." The other day I saw this online post to an article on self-compassion. A woman named Amy wrote, "Am I good enough? It seems like a question that I ask myself day in and day out. It's a never-ending struggle to gain favor with my own worst critic, myself. But I have learned once the critic side of me takes a step back, I relax and just enjoy life again." Self-compassion has to come before self-esteem, because we can't feel good about ourselves until we can stop judging ourselves. In our culture, we're constantly told that we aren't good enough. There are so many messages out there telling us we need to have more money so we can buy more things to make up for our inadequacies. At the core of consumerism is the fact that corporations have to sell people more than they need so they can increase profits. Eco-philosopher Joanna Macy teaches us that in a consumerist culture like ours, gratitude can be a form of resistance. Mindful self-compassion gives us tools to notice what we have. It can help us realize and remember that we are good enough, so we can honor the divine in ourselves and in each other. Taking the time to name the things we are grateful for is one way to be more compassionate with ourselves. It's also a way to celebrate all the complexity and wonder of our lives. My hope for each of us in whatever challenge or crisis we might be facing is that we can be kind and understanding with ourselves, that we can be present with our feelings in each moment, that we can know that we are all human. We all face suffering. We all make mistakes. And yet, we are all good enough. I hope we can remember that even with all its complexities and sorrow, life is full of beauty and wonder. Only when we can accept both joy and pain will we truly recognize the richness of life, even in hard times. May this ever be so. Amen and blessed be.